I've had a lifelong fascination with Hume, and you know, I always think of Hume and Chandrakirti, who's a 7th century Indian philosopher, as the kind of two stars around which my philosophical life tends to orbit. But thinking about how to teach Hume in the context of PPT forced me to see much deeper connections between Hume's approach to topics like the self, causation, but especially ethics and the philosophy of science, connections between what Hume is doing and what Chandrakirti is doing that I hadn't seen before.
I'm Malcolm Keating, and you're listening to Sutras and Stuff. Today on the podcast, how does encountering Indian philosophy make a difference in our thinking about the history of Western philosophy? This episode is the fourth in a series of conversations with philosophers who have taught Indian philosophy at Yale and US College in Singapore, an unusual liberal arts college where students first encounter philosophy through a global two-semester sequence which includes not just Indian philosophy, but Chinese philosophy, Islamic philosophy, ancient Greek and Roman philosophy, and works from European traditions. Because this academic experiment is ending in 2025, I wanted to hear from professors who came to learn about Indian philosophy by teaching it in this global context. Most of them, except for today's guest, were experts in other areas of philosophy first. So what did they learn from this experiment? Did it change their understandings of themselves, of philosophy, of the world?
I'm Jay Garfield, and I teach philosophy. I teach at Smith College in the United States and at the Harvard Divinity School, also in the United States. And I sometimes hang out at the University of Melbourne and at the Central Institute of Higher Tibetan Studies in India. I tend to work on stuff in philosophy of mind and logic, cross-cultural interpretation, Indo-Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, a little bit of ethics, a little history of Western philosophy, this and that.
Jay is an expert in Indo-Buddhist philosophy, and he was involved in designing the philosophy and political thought curriculum when Yale and US began. Among his many books, Jay is known for his translation of Nagarjuna's Mula Majjhima Karika from Tibetan, which Andrew Bailey mentioned back in episode 2, as well as his work on Nagarjuna's Tibetan commentator Tsongkhapa. In addition to a whole range of writing on pre-modern Indian and Tibetan Buddhist philosophers, Jay has also published on Indian philosophy in the colonial period of India. He and his collaborator, Nalini Bhushan, have written a history of that time period, and they've collected important works into an edited volume.
Indian philosophy is a whole philosophical universe. It's not a stray text here and there. And so the longer you spend your time in the Indian philosophical matrix, the more you learn about a lot of different things. My own work includes both work in classical Indian philosophy, primarily Buddhist philosophy, but also looking at the orthodox interlocutors with whom the Buddhists were in conversation, but also late 19th and early 20th century Indian philosophy, looking at Indian philosophy in the context of the Indian independence movement and the Indian encounter with modernity.
Now, with this range of publications in Indian and Tibetan philosophy, you'd probably assume Jay began his career with a PhD in one of these fields, but you'd be wrong.
I wasn't trained in this, and I always say I'm practicing without a license. I attended graduate school at a very straight Western philosophy graduate school, the University of Pittsburgh, and like most people of my generation in philosophy, I finished my PhD not knowing that there was such a thing as non-Western philosophy. But my first teaching position was at a small experimental college in Western Massachusetts called Hampshire College. And the first student who walked into my office on my very first day of work wanted me to supervise his senior thesis on connections between medieval Tibetan epistemology and the social contract tradition. And when he told me that, I thought it was a joke and I burst out laughing. He calmed me down and let me know that Bob Thurman, who was then teaching at Amherst up the road, would handle the Tibetan stuff if I could keep him honest on Locke and Rousseau. So I agreed to do that. I thought starting my career by turning a student down was a bad idea. So I signed on and had to read the stuff that he was reading. So my introduction to Buddhist philosophy was actually reading the rough drafts of Bob Thurman's translations of Tsongkhapa's textbook on hermeneutics.
Robert Thurman, who is now retired, has written extensively on Tibetan Buddhism. Before he was an academic, he was ordained by His Holiness the Dalai Lama as a Buddhist monk.
And it was a dive into the deep end, but it proved to be really interesting. And a few years later, when Hampshire instituted the requirement that all faculty members develop competence in non-Western areas of their discipline or leave, the only place I could turn was Indo-Tibetan epistemology. And so that was my entree. And I never went back.
One of the things that I'm asking everyone is what connections they've found, in particular through PPT, that course, but it doesn't have to be limited there, between Indian philosophy and either other work that they've done in philosophy or their own lives or the modern day.
As you know, I taught at Yale and US in the first 3 years of its existence and helped to design the PPT curriculum and the philosophy curriculum more generally. So this is stuff that's very dear to my heart. And the demise of Yale and US and of PPT is a source of enormous sadness to me. So that's the first thing to say. When we put PPT together, one of the ideas was to begin in China, to end in Asia as well, and to have the West sandwiched somewhere in the middle, so there was no sense of where the center of the philosophical universe is, that philosophy is something that's totally global, and that it's not as though mainstream philosophy is Western philosophy, and then there's Asian philosophy. We really tried to globalize the discipline, and I think we did a remarkably good job, all of us who worked on that, and it's something that still gives me a great deal of pleasure to think about. One of the nice things for me was that in teaching a lot of material with which I had hitherto been unfamiliar, in particular, a lot of work in Chinese philosophy that was somewhat new to me, and indeed some work in Western philosophy that I hadn't thought about before, was to see how much my own work in Buddhist philosophy informed and came to inform over time my reading of Western philosophy and indeed of Chinese philosophy. So, for instance, I've had a lifelong fascination with Hume, and you know, I always think of Hume and Chandrakirti, who's a 7th century Indian philosopher, as the kind of two stars around which my philosophical life tends to orbit. But thinking about how to teach Hume in the context of PPT forced me to see much deeper connections between Hume's approach to topics like the self, causation, but especially ethics and the philosophy of science, connections between what Hume is doing and what Chandrakirti is doing that I hadn't seen before. And so when I came to write my book on Hume, The Concealed Influence of Custom, that book turned out to be heavily inflected by my reading of Chandrakirti in ways that I don't think actually distorts what Hume is doing, but reveals a great deal more depth to what Hume is doing.
The person named Hume, which Jay is talking about, is, of course, the well-known 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. Hume's work focuses on both metaphysics and ethics, and he's famous, or infamous perhaps, for arguments criticizing the idea that we can draw good inferences about the future on the basis of our experience of the past. He thinks we don't have any evidence or reason that justifies assumptions that the future will be like the past. After all, we can't observe such a general rule that the future will be like the past. And we certainly can't infer this general rule based on our experience, because to do that would, well, require assuming that such a rule works in the first place. So Hume appeals to custom as the source of our natural tendency to draw inferences about the future from the past. He thinks we habitually tend to see the world as having such a principle, that is, that the future is like the past. Now, 1,000 years before Hume, Chandrakirti, a Buddhist philosopher in the 7th century, who's part of the Majjhimaka tradition, distinguished between conventional and ultimate truth. He thinks there is an ultimate truth about how the world is, which human beings cannot express in language, but which does not involve entities like selves or phenomena like cause and effect. But he also thinks that we can, at the level of conventional truth, talk about people like Jay or Malcolm or Chandrakirti or Hume. Now, Jay's idea is to link Chandrakirti's convention and Hume's custom. In the ordinary world, ordinary people can describe persons as being born, living, and dying. And this is to talk conventionally. But we should recognize that beyond customs of naming and tracking persons throughout time, according to Chandrakirti, there is no enduring substantial self which exists. Hume appeals to custom to explain not just our erroneous ideas about causation and predictions about the future, but also our erroneous ideas about the self. And this isn't to deny that we have customary practices around persons, which we confuse for evidence that there is some real, enduring, substantial self. I'll put a link to Jay's book in the show notes, where he talks about this in more detail. Let's turn back to how these insights arose for Jay from looking at texts in multiple traditions in the same course.
And so for me, the real value of PPT was sustained juxtaposition of texts between a number of different traditions, and then interacting with students who were encountering these texts for the first time and looking at the connections that they saw between those texts. So I'm going to start with an example. I'm going to start with an example of a student of mine in the first year of the college, and her name was Rachel. I won't use her last name because I don't have permission. But in writing a paper on Hume in the second semester, I had given a fairly cut and dried, boring compare and contrast on Hume and Descartes regarding knowledge. And the opening sentence of her paper was, "Descartes writes philosophy in the first person singular, and Hume writes in the first person plural, and everything else follows from that." And I sat back on my heels and said, expletive, that's a brilliant insight. And it then occurred to me that that was an insight that reflected her earlier engagement with Buddhist philosophy and the idea of conventional versus ultimate truth, of the two truths, and thinking about truth and epistemic practices related to truth as conventions, as collective practices. And then she saw that in Hume. And she saw why Hume was making an advance over Descartes in moving to the first person plural. And that led me to see, my God, the connections between Hume and Chandrakirti aren't just that they each reject the self and accept a person, that they each develop a critique of causality, etc. But it's that they both philosophize in the first person plural. So when Chandrakirti talks about accepting lokavyavahara.
Lokavyavahara is Sanskrit for ordinary practices of language use.
And arguing that pramanas, that epistemic instruments, are just the ones that ordinary people use. He's philosophizing in the first person plural, and it led me to see that that's one of the things that I love about Chandrakirti and that I love about Hume. And so when I came to write the book on Hume, I called it the concealed influence of custom, and that is the influence of philosophizing in the first person plural. That insight came from a first-year student, and this first-year student developed that insight because of the juxtaposition of those texts. And that tells us both how much we can learn from teaching if we keep our ears and our eyes open, but also how much we and our students learn by putting texts side by side that are not ordinarily put side by side.
Well, is there anything else that we haven't said that you think is important in thinking about the connections between Indian philosophy and other kinds of philosophy or the modern world?
Well, just that we haven't mentioned lots of other philosophical traditions. We've only briefly mentioned the great Chinese philosophical tradition. We haven't talked about African philosophy. We haven't talked about Native American philosophy. We haven't talked about South American philosophy. And to recognize that to really globalize philosophy, we have to be open to literature from all of these traditions. That's one of the really cool things about PPT. That was one of the really cool things about Yale and US. And as we lose Yale and US and PPT, we're losing something that was a real treasure in philosophical education in the world.
Yeah, agreed. We can only hope that wherever we find ourselves, we can do our best at globalizing philosophy in those contexts, wherever they may be.
Indeed.
Well, thanks, Jay. I appreciate your time.
And thank you, Malcolm. It's been a joy talking with you.